I'm going to do like a 5-minute review of last time, but first, would anyone like to ask a question before we start? Okay. So let me just do my mini review. We're still, for the first, for this lecture and maybe half of the next one, talking about the geometry and dynamics of the FLRW metric. In the first lecture, I had put a picture on the board of what this expansion history looked like in our universe, but I didn't say anything about how you derive this. It's something that I want to derive today, now that we have Friedmann's equation. So I'll put the picture back up. There's a period of radiation domination lasting about 10 to the 5 years, when the stress energy of the universe is dominated by relativistic particles, and the scale factor grows proportionally to t to the 1/2. And then there's a long period of matter domination, when the stress energy is dominated by non-relativistic particles, where A grows as t to the 2/3, lasting around 10 to the 10 years. And then recently, the universe has switched over to cosmological constant domination, where the scale factor grows exponentially. So today, I'll derive this by integrating Friedmann's equation. Last time, we derived some very central equations. Friedmann's equation, which relates the expansion rate h of the universe to the instantaneous value of the energy density, where let me remind you that h is the fractional expansion rate per unit time, which I'll write as d log a dt. And then the second equation of motion can be taken to be either Friedmann's second equation or the continuity equation. I'd like to use the continuity equation. And so one way of writing it is like this. Let me also remind you the definitions of the FLRW energy density rho and pressure P. They're defined by the statement that the stress energy tensor takes this form by symmetry. I forgot to say last time that the continuity equation can also be written this way. I guess this is the way I might naturally write it down. I'll use the factor of h to trade the time derivative for a derivative with respect to log a. Now with no h on the right-hand side. This form of the continuity equation is often more convenient because you can integrate it without knowing the expansion history of the universe in advance, without knowing h. You can integrate the continuity equation to determine rho as a function of a. And I'll do this shortly for the toy example of a constant W cosmology before moving on to lambda CDM, which describes describes our universe, or at least our current model for what our universe is doing. Put the last few equations from last time back on the board, the equation of state W is defined to be P over rho. That's a general definition for any FLRW spacetime. And as a cosmological model, we're going to consider the case where this is a constant. Then I mentioned that a few cases of interest, there's 1/3 for a radiation-dominated universe. a universe which is full of relativistic particles and no other sources of stress energy. Zero for a matter-dominated universe, if the particles are non-relativistic. And minus one for a universe with a cosmological constant, which is an empty universe plus the law of physics that the stress energy tensor just always contains a term proportional to the metric, or that the vacuum has a non-zero energy density. I'll integrate the equations of motion for this under the assumption that W is constant. When you say that W is constant, that's a prescription for the pressure. It relates the pressure back to rho. And so it fills in the P on the right-hand side of the continuity equation. And it means we have the closed system with two equations and two unknowns. And so we expect to be able to integrate it. It's easiest to start with the continuity equation and to write that as d rho v log a equals minus 3 rho plus p, which is minus 3 1 plus w rho. This equation is straightforward to integrate just by bringing the rho over to the other side and the log a over and integrating both sides. The solution is that rho is proportional to a power of a. So the continuity equation is telling us how the energy density dilutes as the universe expands. I'll integrate Friedmann's equation in a moment to get the expansion history. But first, I think it's illuminating to interpret that power of a in each of these three cases. For radiation, I get, let me start with the matter case. A to the minus 3 for a matter-dominated universe with W equals 0. And so that makes sense physically, because if the universe is full of non-relativistic particles, then when the universe expands, nothing happens to those particles. They just stay at rest. But all volumes increase by a factor of a cubed, all physical volumes. Rho, the physical energy density, is just the number of particles, or rather the number of particles times their rest mass per unit volume, per unit physical volume. And so that would go like a to the minus 3 just because of the dilution as the universe expands. The radiation case, if W is 1/3, then there's an extra power of 1 over a, and that's just due to the redshifting of photons or radiation. If I have a bunch of relativistic particles and they're not being created or destroyed, then the number density of particles would go as a to the minus 3, but then the energy of each particle redshifts as 1 over a, so that the energy density goes as a to the minus 4. And then finally, for a cosmological constant, I get a to the 0. Which is what we expect, because a cosmological constant, by assumption, means that the energy density of the vacuum is constant and does not change as the universe expands. Okay. So that was the continuity equation. And now I'll do Friedmann's equation. Well, yeah, one little notational point I swept under the rug is that sometimes the subscript 0 is used. I wrote rho 0 in this equation. This could have been equals. If I subscript any quantity with 0, that means the value today at a equals 1. Now for Friedmann's equation in a constant W cosmology looks like this. And then instead of using rho zero as the parameter, I'd prefer to switch to, I'll take the square root on both sides and then switch to H naught, the Hubble parameter today. So if you want, H naught is defined in terms of rho naught in this way. Or equivalently, dA dt looks like this. And then this is straightforward to integrate. I'll put in the integration constant for just for clarity. So it usually looks like this, except for when W has the special value minus 1, and that does happen to be a case that we're interested in. So it's usually a power law. But if you set W equals to minus 1, then you get 0 to the 0, things degenerate. And in that special case, it grows exponentially. So in particular, we recover the powers of t, or the time dependence, in the plot from the first lecture, where I said this is proportional to, the scale factor is proportional to t to the 1/2. During radiation domination, t to the 2/3 during matter domination. And exponential for a cosmological constant. Okay. So then.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, yes, yes.
So in the equations you derived, time doesn't start at the same time, right? So. In the first a of t, when t is equal to 0, we get a of t is equal to 0 as well. But in the other one, we have when t is equal to 0, we get a today, which is 1. So basically, time starts at different points in these equations, right?
Sorry, I didn't quite follow that. I suppose one difference. So are you just talking about the constant W cosmology, or in the picture that I put at the top?
The scale factor you derived, because basically what I'm saying is that in the first section, when W is greater than minus 1, we get the value of today, like the scale factor today.
Oh, yeah, now I understand. Yeah. That's absolutely right. So I've chosen to write the equations in a way where in the W greater than minus 1 case, the big bang is at t equals 0. And then the present day, where would be solved by setting a equals 1. So then you'd find t is, you'd set this to 1 and get that t is h naught to the minus 1 times 2 over 3 times 1 plus w, just some sort of, weird looking value. In the case where w is equals minus 1, the physics is a little different because there's no big bang. In a cosmological constant universe, the scale factor is exponential forever, and so you can take t all the way back to minus infinity. And so in that case, I chose to set t equals 0 to be the time today when a equals 1. Thanks. That was a good question. Okay. So then, the expansionist history of our universe is not really more complicated. The only difference is that the equations of motion don't have an analytic solution like they do here. You just have to integrate numerically on the computer. So it's just a small step up in complexity where instead of in a constant W cosmology, in a constant W cosmology, the stress energy is a single component described by this pressure, this energy density, and this pressure. And then the model that describes our universe, lambda CDM, is just the sum of three terms. The stress energy is the sum of three terms, each of which takes a constant W form. So there's a radiation term, which goes like a to the minus four. Associated pressure one third. This model has three free parameters: the densities of radiation, matter, and today, and the cosmological constant. A matter term. I'll put plus zero in the pressure for clarity. And then a cosmological constant term, right, is lambda, with a minus lambda in the pressure. One little comment here is that it's mathematically consistent. If you're defining a cosmology by prescribing rho and p in this way, then you'd want to check that the continuity equation is satisfied. Otherwise, you would have a mathematically inconsistent situation where you were trying to write down Einstein's equations with a stress energy that was not conserved. And so it's true that the lambda CDM continuity equation is satisfied. Because rho and p are the sum of terms which individually satisfy the continuity equation. That was what we showed in the constant W case. And the continuity equation is linear in rho and p. So going back to the plot in the upper left, we can see qualitatively, before we start doing calculations, how the behavior in that plot is going to arise. The first thing to say is that at early times, the radiation is going to dominate because it has the most negative power of A. And at late times, the cosmological constant will dominate. For the parameter values in our universe, there's the values of rho r0, rho m0, and lambda. There's a long period where the matter density happens to dominate. And so that gives rise to radiation-dominated, matter-dominated, and cosmological constant-dominated epochs, ordered by increasing powers of A. And in those respective epochs, one of these terms in the stress energy is dominating the others. And so when we put rho into Friedmann's equation, we'll get an expansion history that looks, you know, deep into each of those epochs, like a constant W cosmology, where the scale factor goes as t to the 1/2, t to the 2/3, or e to the ht. So before I write down, I want to write down some sort of solution to Friedmann's equations in lambda CDM. Unfortunately, it won't be an analytic solution. It'll be a numerical integral that you can put in the computer. And so I thought I would just say a little bit about the notation that you'll like often see in papers. So I kind of like, from a physics point of view, this way of denoting the stress energy, where the parameters of the model are the radiation density and the matter density today and the cosmological constant. But you'll find a different notation. In the literature, so I want to write that down. So let's say that, let me write Friedmann's equation this way. So the first thing that I want to do this is just a change of notation or some definitions, is to define parameters denoted with a capital omega, which are the radiation density today divided by the total density today. That defines omega radiation, and likewise for omega matter. And then omega lambda with the cosmological constant. So these are the parameters in which the contents of the universe today are usually expressed. Just for fun, I'll write down their values. So you've probably seen there's a law of nature that every cosmology book starts with a pie chart that shows that the universe is 70% cosmological constant today. Also known as dark energy, which dark energy means that we're leaving open the possibility that the exponential expansion is driven by something that's not quite constant in time. And then 30% matter, which subdivides into about 5% standard model matter and about 25% dark matter. And finally, just for completeness, I've included the radiation, which is a very small fraction of the stress energy today, but was important at early times. Observation of dark matter and a non-zero cosmological constant are two of the most famous discoveries of physics in the last 50 years or so, and really came as a surprise. The way that the cosmological constant was discovered is basically entirely through the expansion history. There were experiments which measured the expansion history as a function of time, and expected to see it go as t to the 2/3 forever. Actually found this exponential at late times. Nowadays, that's a very high statistical significance statement, as you can appreciate by the small error bar in omega lambda. With current data, the non-zero cosmological constant is detected at around 100 sigma. I didn't write down in the blackboard that this matter component subdivides into a standard model component, which is called omega b for baryonic, which is around 0.05. It's unfortunate terminology, but astronomers say baryonic matter for anything that is not dark. So in particular, that means that an electron would be a baryon in astronomer speak. I'm sorry for that abuse of terminology, but I'm totally, totally hardwired to say it. And then a cold component, which is about 25% of the stress energy. Now, the existence of cold dark matter is not something that can be inferred from the expansion history. As far as the expansion history is concerned, baryonic matter and cold dark matter both just behave as a bath of non-relativistic particles and have the same, you know, W equals zero behavior. But there are other observations that point to the existence of cold dark matter that I'll talk about in a few lectures. Okay, so then, using that notation, you'll see the Hubble expansion rate written this way, the rho tot times omega radiation a to the minus 4 plus omega matter a to the minus 3 plus omega lambda to the 1/2. And then there's one more bit of notation. This isn't It's also usually rho tot is traded for H naught, where H naught is the Hubble expansion rate today, 8 pi g over 3 rho tot. I guess I should have written rho tot comma 0. There's a little more historical baggage in the notation than would be optimal, I would say. So usually you won't find the energy density of the universe quoted in units of energy density. You'll find it quoted as the Hubble expansion rate. And it's quoted in some really weird historical units. So I just... kilometers per second per megaparsec. This is like the usual units that you'll find it reported in. Like people will say, this observation gets H of 70, this other observation gets H of 72. These are the units that they're using. The units, we have a length, an inverse time, and an inverse length combining to give an inverse time. It's like just to explain where it comes from, the Hubble expansion rate was first observed back in 1930 or so as the statement that if you take a galaxy that's some number of megaparsecs away, then its recessional velocity inferred from spectral lines appears to be shifted by some number of kilometers per second. And some more reasonable units, I'll quote this as, I've mostly been using years for, or light years for units of length or time, so I'll quote it this way. Inverse gigayears. In these units, the universe is expanding by about 7% per gigayear. That's an intuitive way of thinking about the Hubble rate. So going back to...
Kendrick?
Yes?
What is the constant C in H naught?
Oh, I'm sorry. This is a G.
A G. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, sorry. Thanks. Okay.
Can I ask another question before we continue?
Oh, yes.
Will we talk about the Hubble tension in this course? Or?
Oh, yeah, I was just about to mention that. Yeah. I had a plan in my head to finish writing this equation and then mention the Hubble tension. I'll just mention it briefly. Okay. Omega lambda. This is the form that you'll commonly find the Hubble expansion rate written in lambda CDM. With all energy densities eliminated in terms of the expansion rate today and the omega parameters, which are like the parameters of the pie chart. I forgot to say that the sum of the omegas is always equal to 1 because they're like fractional contributions to the energy density, by definition. Yeah, so So in response to your excellent question, I waffled a bit when I was deciding what to put. I decided I would put all of these parameters, their measure values with their error bars on the board. And I waffled a bit when I got to H0. I decided to write 70 plus or minus 3. But the actual situation is like a total mess. There's some observations that get like 67 plus or minus an error of around 1. There's other observations that get 73 with a claimed statistical error of around plus or minus 1. And sort of everything in between. And so the overall level of tension is on the order of 5 sigma between a variety of different observations. The biggest tension seems to be between observations from the early universe, like the CMB, where the inferred value of the Hubble parameter today is indirectly inferred through a lot of assumptions about physics. And more direct measurements nowadays in the local universe, which really measure the expansion rate in a more straightforward way. So it's currently an open question whether that large amount of tension between these different measurements is the result of some systematic errors that we don't know about in the different measurements, or some early sign of new physics, because. The different observations of H0 are, many of them don't really directly measure H0. There's a lot of a long chain of assumptions about physics along the way. It's natural to wonder whether what's actually happening is that all the experiments are correct and there's something wrong with all of those assumptions. Like a new species of particle in the early universe is an example of the kind of thing that can break that physics and bring the observations into agreement. One thing I guess that's a little surprising is that you might think that theorists are so good at cooking up models that it would be really easy to find models that bring everything into agreement. But that hasn't proven to be the case. The different models that have been proposed all tend to break something else, like the amplitude of weak lensing observations, the amount of gravitational structure in the universe, like other things that I haven't really had a chance to talk about yet. And so it's kind of a puzzling situation where, in my view, there hasn't really been a convincing model to put forward that would explain the Hubble tension theoretically. So I think that a lot of of us are kind of expecting that there may prove to be something wrong with the observations. On the other hand, the observations have really got a lot of scrutiny. People have dug really deep, reproduced the analyses, and haven't really been able to find anything wrong there either. And so the current situation is really a puzzle. One thing I like about the puzzle is that the data is about to get a lot better. Some of the models that have been put forward to explain this 5 sigma tension, if those models are on the right track, then there'll be 10 sigma effects in a few years with new data. So for that reason, I tend to sort of take an agnostic point of view that we don't really know right now, but we should know in a few years. And I think that's a pretty mainstream view. Okay. So now, I think logically speaking, either of these notations for H is fine, but I kind of default to using this one just because it's what you'll see in papers. So I want to use that parameterization and integrate Friedman's equation to write down the expansion history. And so like one little thing that I didn't point out before is that if the Hubble expansion rate can be written as a specified function of A, as it can in lambda CDM or in the other examples that we've looked at so far, then Friedman's equation can be formally integrated as follows. I'll write it as with dt on this side and dA over AH on the left-hand side. And so if you wanted to integrate the equation on the computer, you could do it formally this way. Or just to write that out for lambda CDM. When numerically integrating, it's more convenient to let the scale factor be the dependent variable and integrate to get the value of the time, even though physically we think of them the other way around. For example, to get the age of the universe, you would run this integral from 0 to 1. And if you plug in these numerical values of all the parameters, you'll get a number around 13.8 billion years. Okay. So, I made a lot of progress, and I'm almost done talking about the expansion history. There's one little loose end that I think is worth tying up, and that's spatial curvature. So I'm going to sort of shift focus. I developed some theory, and then I said at the very beginning that this was a bit of a special case because I assumed that the universe was spatially flat. So now I'm going to sort of do a second pass through where I say what spatial curvature is and put it into all the equations, like Friedman's equations, explain how they're modified a little bit. First, like, maybe this is a good place to pause for questions. Did anyone?
So there's a power of -1/2 for the.
Oh, yes. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I forgot to take this to the -1/2. Thanks. Spatial curvature. Does anyone else have a question they'd like to ask? So spatial curvature is it sort of has the funny property that if you really want to present everything very rigorously and calculate things like the Ricci curvature of spacetime with spatial curvature included. It's algebraically messy and it takes a while. I think in like old cosmology books, it was viewed as a more important thing to do. I think that I'd rather, especially in a 13-lecture course, sort of give you the abbreviated cookbook version where I don't derive everything, but I'm try to be clear about which things I'm not deriving and sweeping under the rug. And the reason for that is just that the observational bounds on curvature are consistent with zero with very small error bars. Even though it seems pretty well motivated from symmetry arguments, we just don't see it. And so most of the time, like when we write cosmology papers, we tend to just not include it and assume spatial flatness. It's a bit of a, in practice, has become a bit of a niche topic. Unless you're doing like a data analysis that specifically searches for it and tries to tighten the error bars or something like that. But it is sort of fun, so I want to talk about it a little. So spatial curvature, in a universe with spatial curvature, there's one new parameter, a spatial curvature K. Which has units of co-moving length to the -2. And to explain what it means by picture, if the parameter k is 0, then we live in a Euclidean universe. And if the curvature is positive, then our universe is a sphere, a three-sphere, even though the best I can do on the board is to draw a two-sphere, with a radius with some co-moving radius, which is related to the curvature by the statement that the curvature is 1 over r squared. And so if your curvature is positive, then if you set out into the universe, then you'll eventually wrap back around and come back to the same place. After traveling 2 pi r co-moving distance. And if the curvature is negative, then you lived in a hyperbolic space. That it's a very interesting object. Just like I can draw a hyperbolic space in. In 2 dimensions, it would really look like the graph of a hyperboloid. It's not obvious, I suppose, that such a space should exist, but there does exist such a space with as much symmetry as the sphere or the Euclidean plane. If the curvature is non-zero, then what that means for the metric is that the spatial part of the metric gets swapped out. For a more complicated spatially curved metric. So here's one way of writing it. I'll denote the spatial metric by dl squared in the curved case. So one way of writing it is in polar coordinates. I won't do very much for this equation. I just want to show that its curvature boils down to some concrete assumption about the metric, which is not too complicated, where the function s sub k is equal to chi if the universe is spatially flat. And so you can see that if the curvature is zero, then what I've written here is just the Euclidean 3 metric in spherical polar coordinates, except that I used chi instead of r for the radial coordinate. I'll explain why that choice of notation is standard, and I'll explain why in a bit. I'd like to explain the geometric meaning of spatial curvature as experienced by an observer who lives in a spatially curved 3 space. So imagine that you're an explorer who lives at the origin in the space, and you decide to explore a circle by heading out from the origin by some distance chi, and then drawing a circle. So you could say that's the set of all points that you can reach by moving a distance chi, and then measuring the circumference of that circle. I claim that the radius that you'll measure is equal to chi, but the circumference is 2 pi times this function s of chi. And the reason that's true is that, like, for any path, you can determine what length would be measured with, like, a physical ruler by integrating the line element dl. That's the meaning of the metric. So For this path, where the angles theta and phi stay fixed, but I just, let's say the radius here is the integral of dl, where I just vary chi, then that's the integral of, let me write it as the square root of dl squared. That's the integral of the square root of d chi squared, just because the prefactor of d chi squared in the metric is 1, chi if I integrate from 0 to chi. Similarly, for the circumference, if I integrate dl, I might, for example, fix theta to be pi over 2 and integrate phi from 0 to 2 pi. Then the value of dl along that path is given by taking the square root of sk chi squared d phi squared, which gives, sorry, with a factor of, yeah, right. Or 2 pi times sk chi. So an explorer would experience spatial curvature as a correction to the usual Euclidean relationship between the radius and circumference of a circle. If k equals 0, those are linearly related. But if the curvature is positive, then this happens. The circumference starts to be less than 2 pi chi, and then eventually turns over and goes to 0 at when the radius is pi times r. This is what you would expect if you live. That's consistent with our, we showed that formally from the metric, but it's consistent with this picture of a positive curvature space as being a sphere. As you draw circles, an explorer at the North Pole, as they draw circles, then the circles start to fall off in circumference as the curvature of the space becomes important, and eventually shrink all the way back down to zero size when the radius is pi times r. Negative curvature is less intuitive, but you can see from the form of sk chi with a hyperbolic sign that the circumference is going to look like 2 pi chi until chi is of order 1 over the square root of the curvature, and then it'll start to grow exponentially. Another way to think about spatial curvature, which is natural to me because I tend to think about telescopes, is that if you imagine that you're at the optometrist's office, and the optometrist has an eye chart, and they walk some distance away from you and hold up the eye chart, then the distance that the optometrist has to walk is chi. But your difficulty in reading the eye chart is proportional to this quantity, 2 pi so chi. So in a positively curved optometrist's office, then the eye chart gets eventually gets easier and easier to read, and eventually becomes infinitely easy to read when the optometrist has gone all the way to the antipode of the sphere. And then a negatively curved optometrist's office, it feels weird, but the eye chart eventually becomes exponentially difficult to read, where every step that the optometrist takes makes it twice as difficult to read or so. Okay. So I've written the spatially curved three metric in the way that I think is most intuitive. But there's another way of writing it, which is algebraically simpler. And that is to make the change of variables from chi to r, where r is just defined to be the function s of chi that we wrote down before. So that's an invertible change of variables. I'll leave it as an exercise to show that in that variable, the metric can be written this way, where the curvature now appears in the dr squared part of the metric, and the angular part of the metric is the same as Euclidean. So in these coordinates, the circumference of the circle is 2 pi r. And then the radius chi is now some messy function of r. An explorer in either coordinate system will agree with the statement that the radius of a circle is always chi and the circumference is always 2 pi r. They just disagree on which of those quantities is like the basis coordinate in their coordinate system. And that's okay because in GR, nonlinear changes of coordinates are allowed and no radial coordinate is preferred over any other. Okay, so next I was going to put curvature into Friedman's equations. Maybe I'll just use my last 5 minutes to just write those on the board. It's quite a bit of algebra. Before we started with the flat FLRW metric and then worked through Einstein's equations to get to Friedman's equations. The metric is a lot messier in a curved spacetime, and that calculation is a lot longer. So this is the thing that I wanted to skip just write down the answer, which turns out to be quite simple. So Friedman's first equation looks like this. Since I'm going to skip the derivation, I'll just put some under braces to explain where this comes from. It's really tempting to carry this new term over to the right-hand side and think of curvature as a contribution to the density, which falls off as 1 over a squared, or at a component with w equals minus 1/3. Formally speaking, curvature is a change in the metric, not a change to the stress energy. But it behaves, for most purposes, exactly like a component with equation of state minus 1/3. And then the continuity equation and Friedman's second equation are unchanged. I'll just write them. Okay. Next time I'll talk a bit about cosmologies with non-zero spatial curvature and what the solutions of Friedman's equation look like. But let me end for today by just writing these equations on the board. And then I'll start next time by writing them back down and talking about their properties. I have a minute left, so is there a, would anyone like to ask a question before we break for the day? Yes?
Curvature, why does the radius shrink to pi r?
So imagine that you're an explorer that lives at the North Pole of the sphere. But you don't know that you live in a sphere. You just think you live on this flat blackboard. Got like a star there. And then you start doing some experiments where you step out by some distance and then measure the circumference of the circle you get. I'll call the distance chi just for consistency with the cosmology notation. For small distances chi, if chi is much smaller than r, the capital R, the curvature radius, then curvature is not very noticeable, and you get 2 pi r. But you can see it starts to break down as the circles get bigger. So if I decide to step out by chi equals pi over 2 r, remember, I don't know that I live on a sphere. But an observer who, like a 3D super observer that knows that I live on a sphere, can see the experiment this way. I step out by pi over 2 times r. And then I measure the circumference of my circle. That's the equator of the sphere, and it has circumference 2 pi r. From the perspective of the explorer, this is a really non-Euclidean statement, because you would expect to get 2 pi times pi over 2 r in a Euclidean geometry. So at this value of chi, the result of the experiment differs from its Euclidean expectation by a factor of 2 over pi. And then things get even weirder if you start stepping out further, because what you find if you step out further than this is that the radius becomes smaller than this value, right? Because in 3D, what's happening is that I wrapped around and I get a small circle. So I might find that the explorer may find that if they step out further than this value of pi over 2 r, then you get a radius, you start getting radii that get smaller and smaller, and eventually go to zero. If you step out by pi r, let's say this outer circle is, pi r, then now you are at the antipode of the sphere, or arbitrarily close to it. And so the circle that you draw has shrunk to zero physical size.